We're going to begin today in Washington, where the Supreme Court gave us two rulings, each a margin of 7-2, giving faith-based employers a lot of latitude on how they manage their employees and distribute health care. So for more, we're joined by WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins from Washington. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So with the court pushing its term out into July, you and I are making a regular thing out of this at this point, Kimberly.
We are. It's the July SCOTUS Chronicles.
That's right. Listen, the first case we're going to talk about has to do with two California Catholic schools. So I just want to disclose that I led a Catholic organization here in Boston for a number of years, just kind of put that out there. Let's start with that ruling, Kimberly. It holds that certain employees of religious schools, religious hospitals, faith-based social service centers can't sue for employment discrimination. What is the thinking there?
Yeah, so essentially what the court considered is something called the ministerial exception to the First Amendment. What it means is the idea is that religious employers whose employees are dealing primarily with the teaching or other practice of religion can't sue for discrimination under federal discrimination laws, because the idea is that would bring the court into a dispute that would largely be about religion, and the First Amendment says that that's not what the government is supposed to do. So there is an exception here. The question in this case is whether that exception applies to people who aren't ministers, in this case teachers, whose jobs involved at least in part teaching religion. And the court found that it does, that these teachers cannot make claims of employment discrimination. Both of them had been dismissed for reasons that they said were discriminatory. The court said there's no action there because their job involved religion and they were employed by a religious employer. So it expanded that ministerial exception.
What was the counter argument from the two dissenting justices?
Yeah, so the dissenting justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissent that was joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Sotomayor essentially said she feared that this will just allow religious employers to claim that any of their employers have some sort of religious role, because claiming so will allow them to escape liability, whether that employee had a real major part in teaching or being involved in religion at all. So she claimed that it just went too far.
So earlier today, Kimberly, we spoke with Andrew Beckwith, who's the president of the Massachusetts Family Institute. He said this is a big win for religious schools. Here he is.
This ruling gives religious schools in Massachusetts protection from what is now recognized as unconstitutional interference by the state in the hiring, firing, and management of employees. And that's a real win for people of faith in the Commonwealth.
Okay, so a couple of questions coming out of what Beckwith had to say there. The first is this just schools? It's not. Does this have a broader application beyond the two schools who were in the court case?
Well, we will have to see. What the Supreme Court usually likes to do is to hold things to the facts of the case. So in this case, it did involve schools. It was a fact-based determination which found that these particular teachers did, in fact, teach religion. That was part of their job. So what will happen when lower courts try to apply this rule is they will start for themselves, for the cases that come up, determining if these employers are in a similar spot as these teachers in having some role in teaching or advancing religion. And as some of those claims are challenged, it may make its way back to the Supreme Court to find out if other employees are still covered under this exception as well.
Okay, and so then the second question is, does this ruling mean in practical terms that religious employers can fire employees who they deem, or at least some set of employees who they deem, are not upholding the religious practices of the faith institution in question? So maybe potentially LGBTQ employees, divorced employees, et cetera.
Yeah, it's definitely a broadening of this rule, a broadening of this exception to bringing non-discrimination claims. That is without a doubt. And again, we'll have to see as these claims are played out, if the courts continue to say, yes, it applies to cases where there's religious objections for any number of reasons. And that is one of that's part of Justice Sotomayor's argument, is that it essentially creates this slippery slope where we can see this exception broadening far beyond what the court intended.
Are there potential implications then, Kimberly, for the finding last month by the court that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act applied workplace discrimination protection to LGBTQ workers? Any concern that these two things come in conflict?
These things come in conflict all the time, and that will be one of the things that the courts will have to balance, not just the Supreme Court, but the lower federal courts will have to balance in the future in trying to figure out just how far this exception applies in these cases. So that's an essential part of this debate.
So a lot more to watch there.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go to the second case, also decided 7-2, also involving employers and religion. This one allows some employers to decline to provide contraceptive coverage on religious or moral grounds. So first, does the court, these seem to be similar themed findings. Is that a thing the court does, group similarly themed cases together like this?
In this case, no. I mean, sometimes if two questions are very closely related, the court will hear them at the same time. But in this case, when you get to the end of the term, the court releases decisions as they're written. So it's largely coincidental that both of these cases came out today.
Okay, and what is the argument of the majority in this case on contraception coverage?
Yeah, so this is what I call just the latest episode in the long saga over the constitutional and procedural challenges to the contraception mandate in the ACA. The ACA provides, by and large, that employers must provide contraception to its employees at no cost to the employee. So first, some religious organizations, churches, objected to that, saying they don't want to provide this coverage. The Obama administration carved out an exception for them, that they don't have to do it. Then there was a challenge saying that the exception wasn't broad enough, that it still required these churches to do something to give folks another option to providing it. Another exception was carved out. So now the Trump administration put in place a rule that really broadened how far this exception went. It doesn't just apply to churches and religious organizations. It can apply to for-profit employers, publicly traded employers, and it's not just for religious objections to providing contraception. It's also an employer need only have a moral objection to providing contraception. So it really broadens this exception. The Supreme Court held that the administration had the procedural right to impose this rule. It wasn't a constitutional ruling on the judgment of this, but saying that basically they had the ability to do this under the law.
I'm going to bring another voice in just a minute, Kimberly, but before I do, what was the basis of the two justices who dissented on this opinion?
Yeah, so Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissent in this case that was joined by Justice Sotomayor. And Ginsburg basically argued that up to now, the court had taken a balanced approach about the right of religious employers and the need of women to be able to access contraception. She said this time the court really basically ceded to the demands of conservative interest in their zeal to secure religious rights. So she essentially says nothing has changed since the last time we considered this, but now the court is veering toward the right for a reason that isn't supported by the law.
Okay, Kimberly, if you'll stand by for a minute, I want to bring in another voice here. Joining us now is Rebecca Hart Holder. She is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts. Rebecca, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is your initial reaction to the court's ruling, Rebecca?
I'd like to say that I'm surprised, but I'm not. It's the decision that we were anticipating, and we really feel that the Supreme Court gave the green light to virtually any employer to deny insurance coverage of birth control to their employees with this decision. The personal beliefs of your boss really shouldn't have anything to do with personal decisions about your birth control. And I think it's really important to flag that this sets dangerous precedent for other healthcare decisions, such as covering LGBTQ-specific services or vaccinations.
So, Rebecca, that really is the question in the tension here, is how widely can this ruling by the court be applied? It sounds like you're concerned that it won't be a narrow group of employers, but you're concerned you'll see a wider group of employers claiming protection under this?
Yeah, we absolutely are. And I think that that is the Trump administration's end game. They've been very clear that they want to roll back the birth control benefit as part of their war against the Affordable Care Act. And certainly if you read Justice Kagan's concurring opinion, she makes clear that she thinks that there will be ongoing litigation about the right of the administration to really curtail insurance coverage for employees.
And what, in your estimation, Rebecca, does this ruling mean for women, especially women here in Massachusetts?
Well, the point about Massachusetts is very important. So when the Trump administration promulgated these regs in October of 2017, we sprang into action and helped get the access law passed. And that was signed into law in November of 2018. And that law mandates that all Massachusetts regulated insurance carriers offer contraceptive methods without copays or cost sharing. I mean, it even goes a little bit farther by guaranteeing that eligible people can receive an entire 12-month supply of birth control at once under Massachusetts law. So the state legislature really embraced its role as a trendsetter on healthcare and pushed back against the regs. So we're very pleased that here in Massachusetts, the majority of people are protected against this. That said, there is real risk for people across the nation who don't have these kind of protective laws.
Okay, that's Rebecca Hartholder. She's the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts. Rebecca, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent, turning back to you, any reactions from what you just heard from Rebecca?
Yeah, it's important to note that states do have the ability to pass their own laws with respect to coverage in this way that imposes additional obligations on employers. It doesn't mean that those employers won't also bring constitutional challenges, but that's always a possibility to do. What advocates I've spoken to said they believe that this will impact as many as 126,000 women in their ability to get cost-free contraception. But in some states like Massachusetts, that would be different.
And, you know, there's a 2020 presidential election going on.
Yes.
These rulings today, do you think they will affect the landscape of that election or other rulings that we've gotten from SCOTUS recently?
Yeah, I think two things. One, these are both wins for the Trump administration that came down on their side. So it's something that the president can tout as a win. And the president has used the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary as a big reason to woo supporters to back him. It's what helped him win in 2016. And it's one reason why if he wins again, that would be a big reason why. So, yes, it's important to the election.
You and I were sort of alluding at the beginning of this conversation to the fact that it's unusual for the court to still be releasing opinions in July. I think it's been since 1996. There's a big one. The court has said that tomorrow is the final day. There are three key outstanding cases. I followed you on Twitter today and saw you note that doesn't necessarily mean that all three will come out tomorrow, but probably, right?
Right. We will probably see. Two of those cases involve President Trump and subpoenas that were issued, one by prosecutors in New York and the other by members of Congress seeking his financial records. It's a question of whether or not the White House can say, no, this goes beyond the authority of those prosecutors and those lawmakers to get those records. By and large, every indication is that those decisions will come out tomorrow, the last day of the year. Now, every now and again, with the Citizens United case being the last example, that decision was scheduled to come out. And because there had been a change on the court, what the court actually decided to do was to re-argue it the following year to let the new justice have a say in it. We don't have a circumstance like that right now, so I can't imagine a case where this decision won't come out, but you never know with this Supreme Court.
And in our last 30 seconds or so, Kimberly, how big a deal is the ruling that's expected tomorrow on the Trump administration subpoenas?
It's a really big deal. It doesn't just mean whether or not we may see these tax returns from President Trump, but it will delineate the breadth of executive authority, how much the White House can stop Congress or federal prosecutors from executing subpoenas and seeking information to a sitting president. So it's a pretty big deal.
All right. That is WBUR senior news correspondent in Washington, Kimberly Atkins. Thanks again, Kimberly. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
It was a heartbreaking 4th of July weekend in Boston. 7 people were killed in under a week. The youngest was 15-year-old Xavier Rodriguez, who went by Rico. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh speaking at a press conference yesterday.
Every act of violence certainly causes waves of lasting trauma throughout a community. Every loss of life is heartbreaking for every single victim and for their families. And when you see a 15-year-old boy or you hear a 15-year-old boy lose his life, it hits home even harder how senseless these acts of violence and these impacts truly are.
We want to have a discussion about it today, and we invite you to call. How are you reacting to the news of so much death last week? Have you or your community been affected by community violence? What policy changes would you like to see to help end community violence? What are the systemic changes that we need? And how are you expressing your empathy and compassion this week? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. So to have a conversation now, joining us is Rufus Falk, director of the city's Office of Public Safety. Rufus, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Mona Lisa Smith. She's the founder and president of the nonprofit organization Mothers for Justice and Equality. Mona Lisa, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hello, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
As I was thinking about how to start this conversation today, I was thinking about the fact that we know most people don't want to die and most people don't want to harm or kill someone else. And yet there was so much loss and death and pain in a short period of time last week in our city. What's going on? What's happening here, Rufus?
So I think it's important for us to recognize that what we saw this past weekend is sort of a continuation that has inflicted upon Boston for the last 30 plus years. I'm 38 years old, and I've been going to funerals for my peers since I was 13, and I haven't taken a year off. There's been a culture of retaliatory gun violence that has existed within our city that has been confined to certain neighborhoods. So I think what we saw this past week is just a continuation of that. On our side, in terms of the city, we've trying to do is try to make sure that we engage those individuals most likely to be a part of gun violence, whether it be the perpetrators or the potential victims, trying to bring resources, trying to make sure we provide an empathetic ear. But I think taking my city hat off for a second, I think it's time that we recognize that this has to be a citywide initiative. It just can't be the residents of Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester being the ones on the front lines. This has to be all of Boston's 22 neighborhoods really standing up and saying that we want to make sure that we are ending this culture of gun violence and making sure that we are doing things to ensure that 15 to 16-year-olds who are growing up on Bolden feel like that they are a part of the city. And that's what some of the messaging that we're trying to put out into the community.
Mona Lisa, what are you hearing from the mothers of Mothers for Justice and Equality and other members over these last few days?
I think Rufus is absolutely correct in saying that that we are experiencing a continuation of gun violence. And what we're hearing and feeling is fear, right? A continuation of the aftermath of that gun violence, which is fear, which is confusion, which is a hopelessness. And that's what we're hearing. That's what people are feeling, that this is continuing to happen. And when do we see the change? When does change happen where we no longer are burying 15-year-olds, where we're no longer waking up to the sounds of gun violence, when we no longer are hearing, gunshots in the middle of the night and waking up to the news where there's just been this loss of life. And I think that's the word, continual. It's a continual impact. And for many who have, as Rufus talked about, that he has been experiencing this and seeing this for so many years, those same victims' wounds are just reopening. So as Mothers for Justice and Equality and so many other agencies work to move people forward, help them to to heal from those wounds and those losses, we're going back to square one because those wounds open. You know, the mother who lost a 15-year-old 5 years ago or 10 years ago now has to relive that moment when she hears of another mother losing her child. So that's what
Mona Lisa, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to turn back to Rufus about that specifically. Mona Lisa just used terms like fear, hopelessness, reopening of wounds. What is the city's role in addressing the trauma of these deaths, the trauma of this loss, the reopening of old wounds, as Mona Lisa talks about, both in terms of moving forward and in terms of future prevention?
I think the first part is we operate fully recognizing and acknowledging that those wounds exist. I think that that's an important part of it, recognizing that a shooting that happens on Humboldt Avenue, is a triggering thing for those folks who have lived in that community for the last 20 years, because that has been a continuous process for them. So much so that folks are so traumatized that when hot weather comes, they're not thinking about all the fun activities that they can do. They're fearful that another shooting is going to occur. So as a city, in terms of trauma, we're trying to make sure that when, God forbid, when an incident does happen, that we have all of our trauma support network, whether that be our neighborhood trauma teams, our Boston trauma response units, and our partners who work within the hospitals, to make sure that they are there to be helpful, to help individuals put the pieces together, but also there for the community, that they know that they can lean on us at those sort of times of need. But we're trying to be now, we're trying to be more preventative and more collaborative. So we'll have our Boston Public School service providers working with us. We have our street outreach teams, our Boston SOAR team, who are our street workers out there trying to prevent violence. We're partnering with BPD around deployment. So we're trying to make sure that we're on both ends. We're trying to be preventative, making sure that we are identifying those families and those individuals most in need. And when things do happen, God forbid, we're trying to make sure that we're providing services and getting services to those who actually need them.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Have you been impacted by this violence? Are you, your family members, loved ones, taking advantage of the city services? Maybe you belong to MJE and are doing work with them or another community organization. What do you think are the policy steps that need to come next? I want to turn to both of you at the same time now, Rufus and Mona Lisa. You've both used the word fear a lot. We've talked about trauma. We're already in a scary time. There's a pandemic out there exacerbating so many things. And the numbers this year are tough. There have been 22 fatal shootings in Boston this year compared to 18 at this time last year. And that's also higher than the 5-year average of 17 for this time of year. So how is the pandemic affecting or exacerbating root issues that are in play here?
Well, Mona Lisa. I think the pandemic is definitely exasperating the situation. And I think one of the things that you didn't mention was racial tensions that are happening as well. So you have the pandemic, you have those racial tensions, and then you have the street violence that has never gone away, that is just continuing when the weather gets warm. And not that, you know, we don't have strong partnerships and there's not a prevention and collaborative and street outreach. All of those things are happening in there, and they are working because we don't have the same numbers as Chicago has, you know. So something is happening, but, you know, like we all can agree on, one life lost is too many. One person shot is too many. So you have these three things happening at the same time. And so wounds are opening from just some of the racial tensions and some of the things that are bubbling up and that have been happening to people in these communities that have been underserved, who were experiencing injustice and inequality, with just not getting murders resolved, with not getting proper public safety, with not trusting police. So those things are starting to surface even more. And then you have COVID-19. So you had people who were already feeling anxiety. They're already feeling, you know, all of these things, trauma, that are trauma related. And then with the pandemic, we're saying, we need you to stay inside, right?
we need to keep the children inside. So we need you all to stay inside, where we know that one of the things that we do to help people recover from trauma is get them out of isolation, back into the population, back serving. So we have to reverse that now to protect them, you know, for a health perspective. So all of these things are having an impact on the emotional health of individuals who are living in neighborhoods with high rates of trauma.
Rufus, there are two things that Moni Lisa talked about there that I want to ask you follow-up questions on. The first, she talked about the racial tensions. You know, we are in our third month of protests over the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis by police officers there. Moni Lisa mentioned follow-up on these homicides. How we've had protests in Boston for weeks now about police brutality and racial tensions. How do we move forward on the prosecution and prevention side of this with law enforcement in this tense moment?
That's a great question. I think it has to start with an acknowledgement of where these tensions emerge from, recognizing that it was not simply about George Floyd. It was about, it goes back to Emmett Till. It goes back, like, these are, it's been a compounding effect of trauma. And this latest, it seems like George Floyd was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And recognizing the history of where these tensions emerge from, I think, is going to be a critical point. And then also having honest conversations and dialogues with our law enforcement and being able to understand their perspective, them understanding our perspective, and then figuring out the way in which the community believes that it should be policed and the way it should be monitored. I don't have all the answers for that. I just know a lot of it's going to come down to us having real honest and tough conversations, and not just having these honest and tough conversations in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. This has to be a citywide initiative. The same energy we had with One Boston when a marathon bombing occurred, we have to have the same energy around these issues. It has to be a citywide neighborhood approach. That's the only way in which we'll be able to have sustainability, because I don't want my 7-year-old daughter to have to be fighting these same fights when she's 17 and 18 years old. So if we're really going to try to end this sort of current climate, or really address it finally, or really heal these wounds, we have to be willing to have honest and transparent conversations across socioeconomic backgrounds and racial and ethnic lines. Excuse me.
So I'm going to skip the other question I was going to ask you, because I want to follow another thread with both of you here. Based on what I've heard from Moni Lisa and what you just said, Rufus, earlier this week on the show, we had scholar Ibram X. Kendi, who has a book on how to be an anti-racist. And he told me that a racist research question asks, what's wrong with the person? And that an anti-racist research question asks, what's wrong with policies or institutions? So embracing that idea in this question, then, what are the policies and institutions that we should be looking at critically right now as failing young people if we are seeing, as you said, Rufus, 30 years of this kind of violence?
I think we have to definitely look at public education. We have to look at our Boston public schools, and we have to listen to our children who have been raising issues regarding, you know, feeling some kind of way about equality, right? Before the racial tensions came about, our children were activated. They were talking about it. We saw a Globe article that said that our children are dropping out of school. We saw the article that said that our children who get into college are not finishing. We know that the test for exam school is not equal, and that many minority children are not getting into those exam schools. So we have to look at public education. We also have to be mindful of the school to prison pipeline, that has not gone away, that we have to be more proactive and not incarcerating our children. We also have to look at how many parents and their families are being incarcerated. So I think there's a lot of systems that have to be looked at and change the way we behave toward them. And there's plenty of policies that have to be addressed. One, for instance, is housing, right? So So one particular policy that has been there and not addressed is when our young people make a mistake, right? And they are charged with that mistake. That family has to move from their public housing. That mother has to make a choice between whether she's going to keep a roof over the head of the other children and send the other child out back into the street because they can't stay there. That is a problem, right? That has to be addressed in order for us to really be able to rehabilitate our children and heal our families. The answer
so,
is
Rufus,
the family.
So what do we do about that, Rufus? How do we support the family the way Mona Lisa is talking about there? And I'll ask you more specifically, the city has launched a new racial equity fund. How can funds from that program, for example, be used to target some of these systems changes, policy changes that Mona Lisa is talking about?
So the first part is I think every institution, city and state, but also community institutions have to be looked at and assessed to see, are they exacerbating biases or discrimination against Black and brown residents in the city of Boston, but also nationwide. And I think that if we're talking about making sure that we're targeting families and targeting, with the idea being to close gaps around whether it be achievement, whether it be around opportunity and access, then that's where funds can come in. That's where money allocated directly in the hands of those who need it the most, we can see a level of systems changing. A lot of this is driven by poverty. A lot of the issues we see within the inner city neighborhoods that we serve are poverty driven. And if we could be more intentional around addressing that root cause, I think a lot of the other sort of unintended consequences that we see would also be addressed. So it's a lot. We live in a country that was founded on racist ideals. So until we can actually grapple with that history, it's going to be really hard for us to really pick and choose what policies and programs we want to address. The entire foundation, this foundation of this country was based on this premise of Black inferiority. So while we have that as the basic premise, then it's going to be difficult for us to build on top of that until we address that root foundation. So it's deeper than any one conversation or one policy, but I think if we're really intentional and serious about addressing what ails this country and the city, it has to start from the foundation, then we move forward. But it's, again, every policy that impacts our neighbors and our community should always be addressed, should always be assessed, and we should always see if there are, because you can have the best intentions, but if you don't have context, you don't have community buy-in, you can have unintended consequences. So I think, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Rufus, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we only have about a minute left before the break, and I do want to give Mona Lisa one more chance to come back in here. And Mona Lisa, with about a minute left, let's end on a message of hope. Where are you finding hope and inspiration right now?
I find hope in the resiliency of the people, that through all of this, you know, whether it be a pandemic, losing our children to senseless street violence, dealing with racial tensions that many of us have dealt with, you know, and become numb to. I find resiliency in the people, that through all of this, the people continue to rise up, continue to have a voice in the middle of the discussion, and continue to maintain a sense of hope. I find hope in the protesters and young people from all different cultural backgrounds, races, coming together and saying that enough is enough. We are tired of being tired. So I think the hope lies in the resiliency of the people. I mean, hearts are broken, right? I can't sit here and say that my heart is not broken when a 15-year-old loses their life. I can't say that my heart is not broken when I read about 7-year-olds losing their life to senseless street violence. I cannot say that, but I can say that I must hold on to hope in the midst of this violence and believe that change is going to happen. So I believe everything is lined up to create the change that we need. And I believe that we are going to see that change. That change is going to come to pass. Unfortunately, we have to go through these storms. But change is going to happen.
That's Mona Lisa Smith, founder and president of the nonprofit organization Mothers for Justice and Equality. Thanks, Mona Lisa.
You're welcome.
And Rufus Falk, director of the city's Office of Public Safety. Thanks to you, too.
Thank you for having me.
While so much has changed this past year, there is at least one thing that hasn't. Sharks. Great whites are still being spotted along New England shores, with 4 detected just today in the waters surrounding Block Island in Rhode Island. Oh, and there's jellyfish too, by the way. Giant jellyfish have been seen off the coasts of Maine, Cape Cod, and Rhode Island. Joining us now on the line is the shark guy in Massachusetts, Greg Skomel. He's a senior scientist at the Massachusetts Division of Maine Fisheries. Greg, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's nice to be here.
And out there, do you have questions about sharks or maybe jellyfish or other ocean creatures on Massachusetts shores? Or do you have any sightings you want to share with us, be it sharks or others? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Greg, 4 great whites in Rhode Island today. The Sharktivity app, and it's so cool that we have one, from the Atlantic White Shark Conservatory shows over 20 sightings in the past month. What is going on?
Well, what's going on is what normally goes on this time of year, you know, as our water temperatures, coastal water temperatures, warm up in the late spring and into the summer. Summer visitors to the area include white sharks, as is the case with a number of fish species. So this is pretty much right on schedule. We would anticipate that the sharks will be showing up right about now, and people will be taking notice, and we get these reports.
So yesterday there was a video posted by the Atlantic White Shark Conservatory of a shark in very, very shallow water off the Lewis Bay area of southern Cape Cod, basically a shallow bowl, quote unquote, of water. Did you see the video and what was going on there?
No, I did not. I did not see that video, but I will make it a point to look at it. I'm not sure what species. I doubt it was a white shark. My guess
The conservatory
shark.
Identified it, yes, as a sandbar shark. That's right. So can you tell us, what are they? What are sandbar sharks? Are they dangerous? Does one need to be concerned about them?
Well, you know, we tend to focus on white sharks because they get the most attention, but we got to also understand there's about a dozen or so species of sharks that visit our coastal waters, you know, from the smaller dogfishes, or sometimes referred to as sand sharks, to some larger sharks like the sand bar or the sand tiger. You know, you don't hear a lot about these fish because they're all, for the most part, extremely harmless. They're occasionally picked up by fishermen that are targeting them or targeting other species from the shoreline. But they're seasonal visitors here, too, and they take advantage of the rich waters that we have surrounding us that explode with life during the summertime.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your question or tell us about your sighting. We've got Rob on the line from Malden. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was just calling because I'm a scuba diver, and I'm curious about the threat of sharks and if there's a way to be updated on when the latest sightings were so I could be more cautious in my diving.
All right, let's turn to Greg for that.
Yeah, Rob, I appreciate the question. I'm a diver as well. And, you know, when it comes to risk or threat from sharks, all we've really got to go on are the statistics. And the statistics clearly show that the probability of being bitten by a shark is extremely low. And very few, if any, scuba divers have been bitten in Massachusetts. I recommend if you're interested in shark sightings, we try to post them as quickly as we can to the Sharktivity app, which is a free app put out by the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. I also caution people not to rely 100% on that app as a public safety application because, you know, those sightings are put up opportunistically. It doesn't mean there's somebody always watching any particular area that you might want to go in. But it does give you a sense of the general distribution of sharks around the Commonwealth.
And, Greg, what should someone do if they see a shark?
Well, for the most part, if you see a shark and you're worried about that shark and you think it's a dangerous shark, and really the only dangerous shark we're talking about here in Massachusetts is the white shark, you know, the other dozen species are harmless. So if it's one of those other species, like a sand tiger, a sandbar, even one of the dogfish, I would enjoy looking at it and take photos of it if you're underwater and scuba diving. But if you're nervous, you're concerned about what species it might be, try to remain calm and leave the water slowly, methodically. Don't splash. Just get out of the water.
Okay, and I'm going to ask a silly follow-up question. I think we're conditioned to think that all sharks are dangerous. So in that moment of anxiety, how does one determine whether it's one of the dangerous kinds or not?
Well, I mean, for folks who are going to be swimming in areas where they think they might encounter a white shark, you know, the great white shark, and that is the only real dangerous shark we have in Massachusetts waters in the summertime, I would suggest you become familiar with how to identify these species, you know, and also get a sense of where these animals are occurring. You know, we put a lot of our information up on the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy Facebook page. We put a lot through the Mass Division of Marine Fisheries showing the areas where white sharks occur. A lot of the media outlets cover it as well. You know, in particular, the Outer Cape is where we see the highest densities of white sharks. So if I were to be swimming in the Outer Cape area, I would probably proceed with caution as opposed to other parts of the state.
Let's grab another call here, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Robert on the line from Westport. Robert, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My question's about jellyfish, and I have a sailboat in Westport, Mass. And it seems to be a this year phenomenon that the big, large red jellies came out in full bloom. And as you guys know, probably they sting a lot. They hurt, and they kind of interrupt my swimming ritual, if you will. But I grew up with them in Long Island in Sag Harbor many, many, many years ago, and now all of a sudden I'm seeing them here. Is this a result of climate changes and water temperature changes? Because I've never seen them down here before. I mean, I've been here, say, 8-9 years.
Okay, Robert, thanks for that. And Greg, if you'll sit tight, I want to bring in a voice who can help us answer that question and also talk about the jellyfish. Here Great. With us is Chris Dollar. He's supervisor of changing exhibits at the New England Aquarium. He's been with the aquarium for 15 years and has worked with jellyfish that whole time. Welcome to you, Chris.
Thank you.
So I'm guessing you can answer Robert's question just there.
Yeah, the one he's referring to, it's the one that's making the news quite a bit lately. That's the lion's mane jellyfish. It's got that real dark red appearance. And the answer is that they're actually pretty common in New England. They stretch all the way up into the Arctic, and they can go all the way down the coast. This year, like he said, we've been seeing quite a number of them, and they've been getting quite big. So, you know, whereas last year we didn't see too many, they were there, but this year there's just been an outbreak. So we can see them right out our windows from the aquarium. We can see them in Boston Harbor.
And there are some big ones, Chris. A colleague of mine actually texted me just before the show a picture of one that his wife saw just off the front of her kayak. You saw a 5-foot long lion's mane. So what is going on? We are seeing more. They are bigger. Why is that, and how dangerous are they?
Yeah, it's the question that everybody's asking. Why so big and why so many? And we just don't really have a good answer at this point. They need to eat. So if I had to make an educated guess, it's that there's more food in the water, more food available to them. They eat mostly plankton. They also eat other jellies in the water. And whatever's out there is enough to sustain them and get them to those huge sizes. Typically in New England, the lion's mane doesn't get much more than, say, dinner plate size. But like you said, we've had reports come in that they've been 4 and 5 feet wide. And that's typical more in the colder climates, so further north of here, not so much in Massachusetts and surrounding areas.
So let me bring Greg Skomel back into the conversation as well. I don't know if the two of you have ever met before, but let me ask you both. The other part of Robert's question out of Westport was climate change. Are we seeing any changes of behavior in either of these species, or are increasing awareness and coexistence with them right along the shore that has to do with climate change? Greg, maybe you can go first.
No, that's fine. Sure. You know, there's been a tendency because of what is perceived as a sudden explosion in white sharks. There's been a tendency to think that climate change is associated with that. But I, you know, based on all the data we've got, what we're seeing is highly correlated with the repopulation, the recolonization of our areas by seals as a result of conservation and regulations that were put in place decades ago. So really what's happening with white sharks is they're moving in closer to shore to take advantage of a robust seal population upon which they feed. I think what's going to be interesting with regard to climate change is how warming waters, in particular the Gulf of Maine, changes the distribution of the seals, because they tend to be temperate animals that prefer cooler areas, and how that impacts sharks down the road. So that'll be interesting and certainly something worth watching.
And Chris, actually, we had a tweet question come in before we're going to run out of time soon, so I want to get this one in. It said, we were walking around Lob Lolly Cove in Rockport at the end of May and found a large gelatinous mass draped around the rocks at low tide. If it hadn't been so huge, I would have said it was a jellyfish. Is that possible?
Based on everything we're hearing, it's absolutely possible. We've seen pictures of them washing up on beaches that, you know, people are lying down next to them to get some perspective, and they're definitely in the 4 and 5 feet wide range. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
So Chris, before I go back to Greg one more time, there is one other question I want to ask you, and this is actually about the aquarium itself. How are the animals? You know, we've seen lots of viral videos about penguins at various aquaria around the country. There's an adorable penguin cam at the New England Aquarium. But they've been without interaction, sort of their visual stimulation of people through the aquarium for quite a while now. How are they doing?
I would say everybody is doing great. But the good news is we've had a dedicated staff of animal care folks here throughout the pandemic. So we've been interacting with the animals just like normal. Everything's gotten extremely wonderful care during this time. Well, we've been shut down, but we're also very excited to have visitors revisit the aquarium once we reopen next week.
And Greg Skomel, back to you. I know you get asked this question all the time, but since we're headed into our beach weather or firmly in it now, I'm going to ask you again. What is your message for beachgoers this summer?
Well, you know, I always say, you know, similar things, and that is it's really important that people understand we've evolved on land, we're terrestrial animals, and anytime we go in the ocean, it's a challenging environment for us. So know your own strengths and weaknesses in the ocean. Know what lives there. You know, these big jellyfish sting, and people ought to watch out for those. There may be sharks in those areas, particularly along the Outer Cape, that are feeding in shallow water close to seals. And also realize there's riptides and currents that are extremely dangerous and have certainly taken more lives than sharks and jellyfish. So know your strengths and weaknesses in the ocean.
All right, that's Greg Skomel, senior scientist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, and Chris Dollar, supervisor of changing exhibits at the New England Aquarium. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.